Whether or not atonement is metafiction or historiography has been the object of much debating already, so I'm not going to go into this. Let it just be said that it engages with the traces of the past and raises questions about how one writes about the past, how one comes to terms with it, confronts it, and possibly atones for it. Seeking ways of confronting the past, of articulating it into meaningful narratives, atonement could well belong in a literature of testimony or witness literature. After all, its felix culpa, so to speak, occurs when young Bryony witnesses a rape, indicts the wrong man, and fails to recant when she starts realizing that she might have made a mistake or committed perjury. She spends the rest of her life atoning for this error of judgment and subsequent act of cowardice, her atonement taking the shape of a quest for form. She obsessively writes and rewrites the story of that fateful summer day and of its wartime consequences. So the main question with which this paper is concerned is how can a novel which creates so much referential trouble, which comes and goes between fact and fiction, bear witness? How can a creative writer bear witness? One way of accounting for the complex construction of atonement is perhaps to see it as an exploration of different ways of bearing witness in literature, and I'm going to start with historical and accuracy and verisimilitude. The relationship of testimony and literature is a problematic one. As a discursive act, which is commonly understood as positing the impossibility of dissembling and which testifies to what one saw or experienced, testimony is supposed to be predicated both on the real, something happened, and on the truth, I'm telling the truth. As such, it may appear as the opposite of fiction. In his preface to Littérature, Fiction, Témoignage, Vérité, Jean Bessière starts from this opposition between testimony and fiction, and from the generally accepted idea that fiction may at best represent a testimony, as it represents other discursive modes, but cannot be a testimony itself. Yet, Bessière continues, fiction can tell a truth which cannot be told by other discourses when, for instance, it has become impossible to bear witness through other modes. Fiction can bear witness when eyewitnesses have disappeared, for instance. And the acknowledged status of fiction, l'aveu de fiction, as he says, does not matter so much as the quest for the truth and the representation of what makes testimony impossible. Thus, it is not impossible to consider Bryony's fictional narrative as a testimony. In the postscript, she defines her literary venture as a quest for the truth, having taken up most of her writing career. She says, quote, like policemen in a search team, we go on hands and knees and crawl our way towards the truth. Her account of a crime and of the marshals is a literary recantation, which Bryony claims is as close to the factual truth as can be. She says, I've regarded it as my duty to disguise nothing, the names, the places, the exact circumstances. I put it all there as a matter of historical record. So much so that she incurs legal action on the part of the marshals if she publishes it in their lifetime. So Bryony recants in this written testimony, committing an exonerated Robbie to memory, before she can no longer remember and eventually dies. In a way, her testimonial novel is a testament, and Derrida, in Poétique et Politique du Témoignage, reminds us that testimony and testament proceed from the same Latin root. In her rendering of the Dunker evacuation, Bryony's quest for the truth takes the form of a pointillist approach to verisimilitude, which is a quote. The postscript lays bare the nuts and bolts of her novel, the better to emphasize her concern for historical accuracy. Bryony has carefully researched her topic and her use of source material is not unlike that of McEwen, as he explained in an interview. He considers historical accuracy as a weighty obligation. Thus, in the age of testimony, the pointillist approach to verisimilitude takes an ethical turn. Historical accuracy and consistent lifelikeliness are a duty. However, the integrity of referential illusion is challenged by the metafictional dimension of atonement. It exhibits the deceptive sham of seamlessness, the impossible continuity of word to world, and the fact that we know the past only through its textualized remains. As such, the metafictional dimension may actually participate in the testimonial function of the book. It's a form of avowal, of confession, guiding us towards an understanding of the constructed nature of the truth. Now, the second channel that McEwen explores is what he calls the telling detail, so in testimonial function. Right after claiming she derives so much satisfaction from the pointillist approach to verisimilitude, Bryony makes a seemingly contradictory statement. She says, "If I really cared about facts, I should have written a different book." Indeed, she has written a novel, not a historiographic narrative. Shoshana Feldman is one of those scholars who consider that literature can bear witness as literature. The task of literary testimony, she says, is to open up in that belated witness, the reader, the imaginative capability of perceiving history, what is happening to others, in one's own body, with the power of sight, of insight, usually afforded only by one's own immediate physical involvement. End of quote. The novel is capable of telling what is happening to others, as she says, especially by entering their minds. In an interview, McEwen underlines this wonderful capacity while defining the nature of Bryony's atonement. It's quote number two. I'm not going to read the quote. He says that the novel is the best art form for entering other people's minds. And Bryony herself becomes aware of this possibility while watching the bewildering fountain scene from her window, which is handout quote three. So accordingly, part one operates several shifts of perspective on one day of 1935, presents different perceptions of the same reality, which act as counterpoints to Bryony's. And in a way, then, it recreates a community of witnesses whose sometimes conflicting versions add up either to complete the picture or to destabilize it. And Robbie is the witness she chooses to challenge the national myth of the Dunkirk evacuation, since part two is entirely focused through his eyes. So the gripping entering Robbie's mind, the reader is plunged into the insanity of war. The gripping quality of the narrative is supported by historical accuracy and verisimilitude, but entering Robbie's mind gives us a feel of the war, to paraphrase Lacapra. He says that narratives in fiction may also involve truth claims, by offering a reading of a process or period, or by giving at least a plausible feel for experience. So in order to convey the feel of war, McEwen makes use of what he calls the telling detail, which projects unspoken emotion, and which has little to do with verisimilitude or reality effect, and has the capacity of bearing witness to an experience that challenges cognitive frames and representation. So before I examine some of those telling details, I should say a few words about Jacques Rancière's conception of testimony, which he discusses in a 2009 lecture at the Collège de France. Rancière does not see the opposition between testimony and literature as the opposition between what is real and what is invented, but between two different literary poetics. a poetics resting on the accumulation of details on the one hand, and a poetics founded on the disruptive detail on the other. Testimony belongs to the second category. It is a poetics of the heterogeneous element, of discontinuity. It focuses on an arresting detail which disrupts the experience of the everyday and the transmission of the experience. From this disruption emerges a pure present, which, Rancière says, is the opposite of a memory. Distance is abolished. The past is resurrected. So testimony is a departure from realism, conceived of as an accumulation of details which represent the continuity of the everyday and creates continuity between the fictional world and the world as we know it. So testimony does not rely on the continuities of reality effect. It relies on discontinuity. In this disruption lies the pure present of the resurrected event. Part two of Atonement begins with, quote, "There were horrors enough, but it was the unexpected detail that threw him and afterwards would not let him go," end of quote. And sure enough, some such detail soon pops up, approaching a cottage which has been destroyed by a bomb. Robbie spots a leg in a tree. You all know the passage, which is a quote five. "The leg is so incongruous up there in the plane tree, so unnatural, that Robbie sees it as an artifact, a perfect leg on display. The leg suspends time. The descriptive pause is itself a fragment of time, disrupting the already diseased temporality of war, a kind of perpetual present, as Kate McLaughlin shows. The leg is an icon of disjointedness, a severed limb, totally out of place in a tree, reflecting a world gone out of joint and disrupting the transmission of the experience. The leg is a mute witness that speaks for itself or that inscribes silence in speech. And Robbie is speechless. He doesn't comment on what he sees. He just throws up behind a barn. The interruption of the flow of time by the disruptive detail, which doesn't have to be gruesome, by the way, is identified by Rancière as the temporality of testimony, in that it makes for the resurfacing of the event. In part three, disruptive details crop up when the wounded flock in from Dunkirk. In the Luc Corneille episode, for example, we get to peep into the head of the dying soldier, which is in fact a horrific variation on entering someone's mind. The side of Luc's head was missing. The hair was shaved well back from the missing portion of skull. Below the jagged line of bone was a spongy mass of brain, several inches across, reaching from the crown almost to the tip of his ear. She caught the towel before it slipped to the floor, and she held it while she waited for her nausea to pass. The scene has been very aptly analysed by Adèle Cassignol and Elsa Cavalier as Bryony's experience of what La Capra calls empathic unsettlement. The passage is also a kind of monstrous literalization of entering someone's mind. The war has transformed viewpoint into this nauseous and silent voyage into someone's damaged brain. The missing portion of skull and the jagged line of bone are shocking elements of discontinuity which convey the untranslatable extremity of the experience. Besides, the jagged line of bone may be an echo of the cracks of the Meissen vase, a keepsake of the First World War. So now the vase is splintered beyond repair, and the heroic memories of the First World War have given way to this unsettling re-presentation of unheroic, unspeakable waste, which leaves Bryony speechless. Third part, testimony and uncertainty. In Poétique et politique du témoignage, is it over?
Nearly,
I can stop.
No, don't stop. Just
okay. Jacques Derrida claims that testimony is not predicated on the truth, but on uncertainty. There's an opposition between closure and openness in the passage where Bryony eyewitnesses the rape. So she moves from, in fact, she moves from an error of interpretation to closure, as she says, you know, it's a shrub, it's the sound of a duck, and in fact she says, now I know it, I saw him, and so on. And in fact, that it is in closure that her crime lies, really. And then there's another form of closure that is imposed upon her eyewitness account by the police this time, because they move her testimony from the field of uncertainty to the field of knowledge. It becomes incriminating evidence. It takes testimony into the field of knowledge where it does not belong. Bryony's narrative only recovers its status as testimony once she has become capable of exposing the truth as a cultural or social script open to distortion, delusion, prejudice, whether in the mind of a young girl or in those of police constables, confirming what they already knew, is the end of the quote. Thank you.
Thank you.